FilmSpotting is brought to you by Spout.com. Spout presents Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com and by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting for more details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, Maddie and I triumphantly return from our pilgrimage to Park City, Utah, though Maddie obviously with a little bit of a cold, to present to you our top five 2008 Sundance Film Festival entries.
Plus interviews with Barry Levinson, director of What Just Happened, and Marina Zenovich, director of the documentary Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. Both movies premiered at this year's fest.
We'll also have listener feedback, massacre theater, and music from Utah Carol. But first, a bit of Oscar talk. Maddie, of course, the Academy Award nominations were announced earlier this week, and I thought we should spend at least a few minutes here going through at least the six major categories, going through the list of nominees and maybe making a few comments on any surprises, disappointments, snubs, that kind of thing. Of course, we will save our actual Oscar picks for a later show. Let's start with Best Picture here, the list. Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by any of those. I think all five are deserving of their nominations, and I think it really speaks to the strength of the films that we had in 2007. Of course, me personally, I wouldn't have put Atonement in there, but I think all five are good. Michael Clayton, yeah, perhaps a little overrated, but a solid thriller nonetheless.
Yeah, it is. I'm actually not shocked by any of the picks there either, and I actually would go so far as to say that I think it's one of the best crops of Best Picture nominees we've seen in a while, at least if you look back at the last 2 years. I went and looked at the Best Picture nominees. You look at 2006, Babel, The Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen. Four solid films in there for me. Babel, I didn't like, but you've got that one film I didn't like, and then The Departed is the only one that made my top five films of the year. 2005 Best Picture nominees, Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Crash, Good Night and Good Luck, and Munich. Some good stuff in there. Crash I didn't like so much. Brokeback and Capote, the only two that were in my top five of the year. This time around, four of these five nominees were in my top six films of the year.
And I think there's a lot of parity among these five. I really think it's kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you're going to look at it, you know, There Will Be Blood is probably going to take away votes from No Country for Old Men. Atonement could end up winning. I don't think Juno stands a chance.
No.
That's my Jimmy the Greek call right now.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Juno probably doesn't stand a chance, but of course we love that film and we're happy to see it get a nomination. I was very happy to see Atonement in that list as well. I would say the only disappointments for me, of course, I would have liked to have seen Zodiac in there or The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, but not a shock that either of them got overlooked in this case.
Okay, let's move on to Best Actress. The nominees are Cate Blanchett from Elizabeth the Golden Age, Julie Christie from Away from Her, Marion Cotillard from La Vie en Rose, Laura Linney from The Savages, and Ellen Page, Juno.
Well, from those nominees, I am a little bit surprised about Cate Blanchett, even though she's Cate Blanchett. But she also got a Best Supporting Actress nomination, as we're going to see here in a minute. And that film just was pretty much universally panned.
We didn't see it, so no. We really can't comment on it. But you're absolutely right.
Right. She could be deserving, but we just didn't see it. And no one else saw it either. So a little bit of a surprise there.
Yeah, I'm really happy Julie Christie got nominated. And obviously, Ellen Page. We both think she's fantastic.
Yeah, both of those nominations are great. Not a surprise with the other two. A little disappointed maybe that Tong Wei didn't get a nomination for Lust Caution, but not a surprise. And then also I would say Keri Russell. Again, not a surprise, but I really liked her in Waitress. So she would be another one I would think of. Best Actor, the nominees are George Clooney, Michael Clayton, Daniel Day-Lewis, There Will Be Blood, Johnny Depp, Sweeney Todd, Viggo Mortensen in Eastern Promises, and Tommy Lee Jones in The Valley of Ayla.
I'm really not surprised with any of these picks. I actually really like them. I think a lot of people are surprised that Tommy Lee Jones got it for In the Valley of Ayla, but I think he's deserving.
He
really is fantastic in that film. Of course, I'm a little bit upset that Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie's co-star in Away From Her, didn't make it, but I have no problem with any of these performances.
No, I agree. All these are solid to great performances. No surprises here for me either. I would have liked to have seen Josh Brolin maybe for No Country for Old Men, despite kind of a smaller role. Frank Langella, I loved, of course, in Starting Out in the Evening. I thought maybe he had a shot, even though no one really saw that film.
Yeah.
And then I'm with you, Gordon Pinsent. I thought he definitely had a shot. He deserves to be in that top five. I think he was your favorite male performance of the year.
Yeah, I really feel he's equally as good as Julie Christie, and I hope this doesn't come out the wrong way, but, you know, it's easier to play the person with the disease sometimes than it is to play the people affected by it.
This has come up on the show before. William Goldman made the case that Tom Cruise was the guy who deserved a nomination for Rain Man, not Dustin Hoffman, kind of famously. So there you go.
All right, let's move on to Best Supporting Actress. Cate Blanchett, no surprise there from I'm Not There. Ruby Dee, American Gangster. Saoirse Ronan, Atonement. Amy Ryan, Gone Baby Gone. And Tilda Swinton from Michael Clayton.
No surprises here either, except I will say Ruby Dee. Not a surprise because she's gotten buzz. I think she may have gotten a Golden Globe nomination.
And so she also made the Mattie Robinson Top 5 Supporting Actress
list. She did. For me, though, that's one of those performances. I know for you there are no small performances, but for me that's such a small bit in the film. She has such a small presence in American Gangster that I just wouldn't single her out as one of the top five supporting performances of the year. Everyone else I like, most of them were on our list, so I think they did a good job here as well.
Yep, good choices.
Okay, Best Supporting Actor, Casey Affleck, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, Javier Bardem, No Country for Old Men, Hal Holbrook, Into the Wild, Philip Seymour Hoffman for Charlie Wilson's War, and Tom Wilkinson, Michael Clayton.
Yeah, the only two I would have a quibble with are Philip Seymour Hoffman in Charlie Wilson's War. He's fine.
He's fine.
He's great. He doesn't rise above his Philip Seymour Hoffman greatness. And Tom Wilkinson, I think, is putting on a supporting actor role, like he's trying to get the nomination in Michael Clayton. I think it's a really sort of affected performance. I like Tom Wilkinson. I don't think this is best performance. I don't think it deserves a nomination.
I'm with you on both Tom Wilkinson and Philip Seymour Hoffman. We, of course, love to see the other three nominees, including Casey Affleck. I'm genuinely surprised, not because it didn't deserve it, but because I thought that he would be overlooked. And we actually both think it's really more of a best actor performance.
Exactly. Put him in there.
He's the lead in that film, I think, but glad to see him there.
All right, moving on to best director. We have Paul Thomas Anderson for There Will Be Blood, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen for No Country for Old Men, now allowed, of course, to have two directors attached to the name of a project. Julian Schnabel, The Diving Bell, and The Butterfly. Tony Gilroy, Michael Clayton, Jason Reitman, Juno. Adam, what stands out for you there?
Well, Julian Schnabel getting one for Diving Bell and The Butterfly. I'm glad to see it. I think he was masterful with that film.
At the expense of Joe Wright.
But at the expense of Joe Wright, you're exactly right.
And usually how this plays out is it's the little film like Juno, where that director usually doesn't
sometimes
get the nomination.
That one really did surprise me, was seeing that Jason Reitman got a nomination. I mean, obviously, Juno was a nominee for Best Picture, so it makes sense, but everyone does associate that film, maybe rightly or wrongly. We did it too. I don't think we even mentioned Jason Reitman's name more than once in our Juno review.
Probably as Ivan Reitman's son.
Maybe. You know, everyone thinks of that film as Ellen Page and Diablo Cody. There isn't really anything about it that stands out from a directing standpoint, but it's a great film, so he absolutely deserves the nomination. For me, of course, being a fan of Zodiac, little disappointed David Fincher isn't in that group, though.
Well, speaking of the Oscars, you, Adam, had a chance at Sundance to talk with a five-time Oscar nominee and the 1989 Oscar winner for Best Director, Barry Levinson. The film, of course, was
Rain Man.
Very good. Which also won Best Picture that year.
Levinson's new film, What Just Happened, stars Robert De Niro as a fading movie producer, and it's an adaptation of Art Linson's 2002 memoir, What Just Happened, Bitter Hollywood Tales from the Front Line. I began by asking Levinson if he read Linson's book when it was originally published.
No, to be honest with you, I hadn't read it back then. I read an excerpt from it. I believe it was running in, it might have been Vanity Fair, and which I was, you know, really enjoyed. But it wasn't until I got a draft of it that I went back and read the book.
When you did go back and read it, did you see in it the makings of something that could be turned into a narrative from a memoir?
Well, what happened is, I mean, I got the screenplay, and then which had been developed, and actually it was De Niro who sort of, you know, egged Ardoin to turn it into a screenplay. So I read the early draft of it, and I was really intrigued, thought it was worthwhile, and it developed from there. A couple of years later, we finally made it.
What was it in particular that really drew you to it and was something you wanted to make?
I think the combination of the specificity of the business, I mean, a very much of an inside look, and at the same time, I think there is a it shows you the behavior in a way that I think whether you understand any of the mechanics of the business or not, it's immaterial. In the end of the day, you know, I think there's a lot of commonality to it. This is like 2 weeks of desperation in a life of a producer, I mean, trying to survive. And I think there are a lot of those things that seem to connect to an audience, whether or not you know anything about the business. That's been our what we sort of found out by some of the screenings, as far away from media centers as possible and just, you know, getting out to a normal audience and that doesn't know the business, and they respond almost exactly to, say, like the last night screening here in Sundance.
You made Jimmy Hollywood in 1994, and certainly Wag the Dog has the Hollywood satire component to it, and then there are memorable films like The Player as well. Do you feel the need to acknowledge those kind of previous films and try to do something drastically different with a new one or not?
No, I don't think you try to do anything drastically different. I think each film exists in its own time. I mean, if you go back to, it's almost in the DNA of film history, or the business, I should say. You'll see movies about the business from the inception. Star is Born in the 30s, converted into a musical in the 50s. Sunset Boulevard, there's so many of them. And I think each time you have to find a way to define it.
Well, you listed some great titles there. What are some of your favorite Hollywood satires or Hollywood movies that really take that insider's look?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the satire that intrigues me. I mean, there's been a lot of straightforward looks at the business, whether it was Sunset Boulevard or The Bad and the Beautiful, which I really enjoyed, or what was it, 2 Weeks in Another Town that was done in the 60s. I think it was Minnelli again. Countless films that are quite entertaining when you, especially in reviewing them and going back and seeing them years after the fact.
Did you rewatch any of those films in preparation for this?
Not in preparation for it, but I mean, I've periodically, and you pull out something and just take a look at, you know, something from the past. But as I say, you try to do a movie, about the business in its own time, so there's no point of trying to connect to something that was done, say, The Player in the 90s or Stars Born in the late 30s. So you just simply find the material that you can gravitate to and find a way to deal with it.
We're talking with director Barry Levinson about his new film, An Insider's Look at Hollywood, What Just Happened, playing here at the Sundance Film Festival. If you had made this film 10 years ago or 20 years ago, what would that look at Hollywood be like? How would it be different from it is now?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. It's hard to look back and figure out how to change your piece, you know. It's interesting how, if you look at Sunset Boulevard, which is not a parody, not a satire, very dark. You know, you're talking about a guy who's dead in the beginning, who now tells you the story. And The Bad and the Beautiful one, which I've always, you know, gotten a kick out of, and I've always enjoyed. I don't know how to turn back the clock and say, how would I do it then? I can only deal with now in that regard.
Has Hollywood, though, changed in drastic ways, say, in the last 10 years?
Oh, yes, definitely so. And I think you can see it even here in Sundance, because what's happened is the studios are really kind of designed for very big, big, broad type of work. And if you're outside of that, you have to really go an independent route, which is what you're seeing here, and you're seeing it popping up, you know, just in terms of filmmakers around the country. Anybody who wants to try to tell some kind of story that really that deals with people, you're basically looking outside of the studio system. And that's the way this movie had to be done. It had to be done at a very reasonable budget, which is around 20, and having to shoot, you know, say in a 30-day schedule, 33 days actually.
Do you like shooting on that kind of a schedule compared to the bigger productions?
I did Wag the Dog. It was in 29. I'm not like I'm in a foot race, but the economics are the economics of it. I don't mind it if you're planned correctly and you know how you want to handle it. It's fine because the actors don't notice the difference. Not like, all right, hurry it up, it's going to go, we can't do any more takes. We do as much as necessary, but by design you have laid it out in a way to accomplish it with a great efficiency.
This was maybe more of a problem for Art Linson with the memoir, but was there any fear of offending anyone, friends in the business, things cutting a little too close to home maybe?
I don't think so. I think look, it's based on a lot of stories and a lot of people that he may have, you know, crossed the past with over the years, and you just simply do the work of it. He's not trying to, he's trying to point a finger at any one individual. You're just taking the behavior of many and finding a way to fashion a story.
Were there any moments in the shooting of this film that imitated what's either in Art Linson's book or in the film itself?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I don't know if I can go into that. It's a little too soon to tell these stories.
Well, last question for you. You did mention a little bit the reaction the film has received so far here at the festival. Talk about that a little bit more. Has it surprised you at all?
It is consistent, as I say, because we had showed it to audiences that are here you could say, okay, there are people who came to see films and love films, and it's a festival about it. But I could, we've showed it to a place, you know, just some, you know, city, and doesn't, and the reaction is, as I say, almost the same. The fun part of it is that I was talking to a woman just before the early screening this morning. She says, I saw the movie last night. She was working as a helper at the theater. She says, I saw the movie last night. I'm not in the business, so I don't really know anything about the business, but I really love the film. So she was always being apologetic. But she said, and what she reacted to and what she was connected to is what we would hope, in a sense. You know, as I say, you don't have to know the business well to understand the movie. The specificity of it all, I think, is what fascinates the audience. But it's not something that's beyond their sensibilities of understanding. I mean, there's too much about, you know, entertainment out there in a way to go, gee, I didn't know anything about anything, you know?
Well, I really look forward to actually heading out right now to go finally see the film. Best of luck here with the film and at Sundance. Thank you for your time.
Take care. Thank you.
Again, that was director Barry Levinson, who I caught up with on Main Street last weekend at Sundance. And then after the interview, Maddie, we both did see What Just Happened. Does it belong in the same pantheon of movies about Hollywood like some of those Levinson mentioned, Sunset Boulevard?
Well, not quite, but I think I enjoyed this film probably more than you did. I just had a good time with all these actors. They know this world so well, so they can do it really authentically. So you have Bruce Willis riffing on things. You've got, of course, Bobby De Niro playing this the producer. So it's a lot of fun. Ultimately, I think we sort of hit on this earlier, there's just a few too many subplots that just don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did talk about this film a little bit in one of our two Sundance dispatches. You can listen to those podcasts at filmspotting.net, of course. And that was really the thing for me, is just it didn't have that crackle, the crispness that you need from a good Hollywood satire. Even the things with Bruce Willis. I mean, sure, he's fun, but he plays this actor who, of course, he's playing Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. And he comes into a film set, he's overweight, and he's got this huge beard that he won't cut. And it's like, you hear tales like that sometimes, but honestly, the whole thing was a little phony. And then when he gives his big rant and he just rages through this trailer and starts throwing things, it's not funny. It's like a 5-minute scene that, at least in the press screening we were watching, everyone just kind of sat there. And so it just doesn't crackle with the humor and have that bite to it that I think a good satire should have. But you're right, De Niro is fantastic to watch.
And it's too bad, too, because the first 5 minutes are absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away the big punchline, but they really, really are funny. And I also like Levinson's use of diegetic sound in this film. In fact, I wish he would have stuck with it all the way through. He kind of abandons that motif about halfway through the film.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and listeners feed Maddie to the Cloverfield Monster. Please stay with us.
You thought life on Earth was meaningless. You despise people. So what'd you do? You ran out.
No, it's not like that, Landon. I'm a seeker, too. But my dreams aren't like yours. I can't help thinking somewhere in the universe there has to be something better than man. Has to be.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a shot at winning a free DVD. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard from the original, not the remake, Planet of the Apes, a tie-in of sorts with our review of Cloverfield.
Of course, the Statue of Liberty figuring prominently in both films. I think I can say that Planet of the Apes is how many years old now at this point, but we did get a lot of great feedback in responses to this pick, Maddie.
I absolutely love our listeners because they can't just write in the answer. They have to actually put in a quote. It's
terrific. Maniacs.
You maniacs. You blew it up.
We heard that a lot. And I also like this one from Steve in Westminster, Maryland. Adam, that was either the worst Heston impression I've heard or the best Heston parody. I'm not quite sure which, and I'm betting you aren't either. I don't know. You're right.
All right, Adam. Either way, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Raymond Ash from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, I know where that is.
You do?
Yeah.
Yes. We all know where Seattle is, Maddie. Congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, it ties in directly with this show, as usual. And, of course, we will just say, think about Sundance. That's really all you should need to know. And, Maddie, I do understand that you may have a small disclaimer you want to put forth before we do this scene.
Well, I just always want to, I want to give our listeners sort of a look at the inside, the inner workings of film spotting.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I'm a team player.
You are.
You know, this is not my favorite film, but I realize it's beloved by many people, so I'm more
than happy. And a great tie-in.
I am more than happy to put it out there. You, on the other hand,
what?
Go out of your way. If you don't like a film, you will go out of your way to denote it. It's like you think A.O. Scott's going to be listening and you don't want to offend him, or Ebert's going to associate you with that movie.
I don't know what you're talking
All
about.
All you need is love, man.
Yeah. Well, you are a team player. We do appreciate it, Maddie, because this is a perfect scene for this show, so we're going to give it a shot, even though you don't like the film and you're totally insane.
Under protest.
Okay.
Here we go.
I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
Come in. Come in. We meet at last.
This is a swell office.
Mere creature comforts.
Could use a little bit more light, though.
Where are you from, Blank?
All around, really. What about you?
Please pardon the absence of light. You see, as a youngster, I was frightened of the dark, and I used to wake up sobbing in it as if it was water, and I was drowning in it. As you will observe, I have disciplined myself against that fear, that now I much prefer a dark room.
The only thing I know about the dark is you can't see it.
A pure canard.
What's a canard?
A prevarication.
What's that mean?
A lie. You can see, you know.
Well, not good enough.
You see me, don't you?
Maybe I do, maybe I don't.
And scene.
Oh, Adam, I think you found some audition material.
You like coming into my own
that
here?
That monologue, I could hear you say that. You see, as a youngster, I was frightened of the dark.
I
could hear you.
I went
you.
Back I to my own fears as a child.
It's beautiful.
In the dark,
absolutely
yeah.
beautiful. I could listen to that for hours.
If you know what film Maddie and I just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, January 30th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, it's Joel coming to you from Denver, where I just got back from the midnight showing of Cloverfield. I'm a longtime listener, never called in, but I just had to after seeing this movie. My two-word review, holy crap. I mean, it's far from a perfect movie, but just the whole handheld, claustrophobic nature of this movie and the way it shot was just so real that it took me right out of the theater and right into the mess with the characters.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, this is Justin McCumber from Fort Worth, Texas. Just left the theater from seeing Cloverfield, and it was one of those weird situations where on the drive up there, I was listening to your review of the film, and I have to say, coming out of it, that I completely and totally cannot see problem people have, and Maddie seemed to express it, about there being no character development in Cloverfield. I mean, this is not Remains of the Day. It is not a Jane Austen remake. This is not a film about character development. It's a film about, you know, a terrible thing happening. It's about devastation and a monster attack. It's a group of people running in fear for several hours of their lives. I mean, really, where do you expect there to be a lot of moments for people to sit down and exchange ideas and thoughts?
Hey guys, Andrew James here out of Minneapolis, just calling regarding your review of Cloverfield, specifically some of Maddie's comments, which I think one of the main problems he had with the film was that these were actors, but they felt like Gap models sort of running around screaming for their lives, and he just felt detached and didn't feel believable. And I actually had the exact opposite thought. I felt that the fact that I didn't know these actors, they're sort of no-name actors, really worked. It was a bunch of kids that I don't know living in New York dealing with this problem. And I mean, I don't think it's Oscar worthy by any stretch, but it's certainly much more believable than, say, the characters in Juno.
We get into listener feedback now with some audio feedback there, Maddie. Joel, all over Cloverfield, loves it. Justin has an issue with you bringing up the point about character development, saying it's not a Merchant Ivory movie. We're actually going to hold off on your response on that one for now because it's going to come up again later in the mailbag. But Andrew there brings up a point that some other listeners wrote in about, and I think they misunderstood you a little bit on the point about the actors in Cloverfield all seeming like Gap models. Do you want to clarify that?
Well, it's not that I wanted to see big-name stars. It's just that I thought all the characterizations were completely indistinguishable. Mm-hmm. They looked like Gap models from a TV ad. You know, basically, I had a hard time telling them apart, especially the brother from the brother. And I actually take a little bit of umbrage with people that say, oh, our friends always hang out and talk like that. They're talking like real people. I'm like, no, you don't. You have great friends. These people sort of all run together in this film.
Yeah, I think they do a little bit, but I am glad that you clarified that, because it wasn't an issue of you saying, I want to see big name stars,
no.
But if you're going to get character development that is lacking, then at least give me Paul Newman, or
right.
give me someone like that, like in a Towering Inferno type disaster movie that, you know, you can kind of hang on to. So I got it, and I don't think you're off base there, but we'll get into some more Cloverfield feedback here in a moment. A lot of our listeners really big fans of that film, but we did want to take a second just to mention a quick correction. And I actually love, in this case, being wrong, Maddie, because I love hearing from some of these listeners. I made a point last week when we were previewing Sundance. I talked about Derek Jarman and how I was looking forward to the Derek documentary that was playing at Sundance, and also his Edward II. And we'll just go ahead and read this email here from Matt in Cardiff, Wales. He says, hi, guys. Am I right? Did Adam really say in Film Spotting 194 that Distant Voices Still Lives, the 1998 Terrence Davies film, was by Derek Jarman, who incidentally was quite dead by this point? For shame, Maddie. Gotta watch your boy's back a little more. He's chugging on the Film Spotting stash again. It's true. Matt wasn't alone in calling me out on this. I did mix up my British directors. I simply had it in my head that Derek Jarman made Distant Voices Still Lives.
Man, you're really bringing this team down.
I know.
We're going to have to talk about this.
I know. We do. Maybe need to have a staff meeting here and talk about it. But I love getting feedback here, because we also heard from Clint Batista in Milton Keynes, England, Richard in London, Joseph Wren in Glasgow, Scotland, and Robert Holloway in Oakland, California. And then we also heard from Patrick Kelly in Malmo, Sweden, who wrote in to correct me and also mention that on the subject of British directors, we both mentioned last week, Maddie, how neither of us have ever seen a Lindsay Anderson film. And he said, you know, from Oh Lucky Man to This Sporting Life to If, he made The Whales of August with Lillian Gish.
Oh, turns out I have seen
You have seen that, so you have seen a Lindsay Anderson film. But he says you got to see some Lindsay Anderson movies. I'm thinking that maybe after we get done with Bergman, and then after we do our Viva Pedro Almodovar marathon, maybe we need to do a little British cinema Lindsay Anderson marathon.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Also, last week, Stephen Alford in Austin, Texas, wrote in, Maddie, and he just mentioned that if we were going to bring up the VeggieTales movie, which I was bringing my kids to, maybe I would quickly say what I thought of it. I did take my kids to the VeggieTales movie, The Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, and we had a blast.
Good.
Yeah, it's a very good movie. You know, if you are the kind of person of a secular nature who really isn't into images of God in your children's movies, then you might have a problem with it. I mean, at the end, we get the king, who is literally God. I mean, he comes through, the mountains part, the sun, the rays shine down. You know, it's definitely very blatant in terms of what it's trying to promote, but just as a good, fun time at the theater, Holden and Sophie loved it, so I can't complain.
Sounds great. I remember, I think I would wake up hungover in graduate school on Saturday and catch a little VeggieTales action. I had nothing against it. I liked it.
Okay, well, let's move on that note to our poll questions. Cloverfield, of course, our review last week, we're talking about it here in the mailbag, and we asked you about J.J. Abrams, who produced the movie, did not direct it, but we wanted to know how you feel about him. So considering Cloverfield and his other projects, J.J. Abrams is a creative juggernaut, almost always interesting, TV's golden boy, unproven in cinema, master of the viral campaign, but that's it, or he's the lost guy, right? Maddie, how did it come out?
Always interesting, 32%. TV's golden boy, unproven in cinema, 25%. He's the lost guy, right? It was a little bit of a surprise, 22%. A creative juggernaut, 15%. Master of the viral campaign, but that's it, 7%. So it looks like our audience not quite ready to anoint him the genius quite yet.
Maybe not, but certainly we do seem to have a lot of Abrams fans out there. This week's poll question, we're asking you about the Oscars, which of course we discussed in the opening segment of this show. And so we're asking, the biggest 2008 Oscar snub was?
Was it David Fincher, director of Zodiac? Gordon Pinson for Best Actor in Away From Her? Joe Wright for Director of Atonement? Zodiac for Best Picture? Or 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days for foreign film?
Maddie, where would you go on this one, even though I'm pretty sure I know you're going the actor route?
Well, yeah, I would have to say Gordon Pinson, but there's a lot of love for 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. And I'll say, I haven't seen the film, so when that wasn't nominated, I was still surprised.
Hmm. Yeah, it really is a surprise, the Romanian film. You look at those Best Foreign Language Film nominees to not at least get a nomination. Really,
it
does have a lot of
people. It didn't even make the shortlist.
No, and I don't understand it. It was a film I did enjoy a lot, even though enjoy is a relative term. It's pretty brutal to watch, but didn't make my top 10, but certainly in the top 15.
And you're going with Zodiac, right?
I'm probably going with Zodiac. Actually, though, I have to go with Joe Wright for Atonement. I had Atonement as my number 2 film of the year, and apparently the Academy thought that one of the 5 Best Picture nominees directed itself.
Yeah.
And overlooked him. So I would go Joe Wright. We want to know what you think. Make your voice heard at filmspotting.net. We do have a little bit of time here in the segment, Maddie, to get into some more Cloverfield thoughts. And of all the feedback we got, and we got a lot because obviously a lot of our listeners did go out and see Cloverfield, everybody was praising this film. Everyone mm-hmm. liked it at least as much as I did or loved it a lot more than I did. You were a little bit more lukewarm on it. And the only person who seems to share your lack of enthusiasm at all is Jordan here.
I'm Jordan, discovering the limits of my genius from Danvers, Illinois. He says, although I liked the idea of the handheld camera thing, by the end of it, it just felt like a gimmick. I didn't have a problem with motion sickness or anything, but I didn't feel like the camera really added anything to the movie. I couldn't shake the feeling that what I was seeing was basically the same storytelling technique that first-person video games like Half-Life use, except you don't get the feeling that you're actually in the shoes of one of the characters. There's no immersion. He's exactly right on that. You don't get to look around and see things unfold for yourself. Video games use techniques like putting story events at the end of narrow hallways or using the art design to guide your eye to a certain point in the environment, but you still get the sense that you're seeing what you want to see. In Cloverfield, it was more like watching someone else play. I kept thinking, hey, what's over there? Look over there, dude. And it sucked.
Some interesting thoughts there from Jordan, though I would disagree with him on one main point, and that is that whole immersion factor in the point of view. I mentioned this during our review, actually, that that's what I liked about the movie. I liked the way it frustrated us as a viewer, that I wanted to turn and see what was coming from the right, but I knew that I couldn't, that I had to rely on the camera person. That, for me, was actually one of the fun aspects of the film. Frustrating, but in a good way.
Well, see, I like the frustration. My lack of immersion, of course, it's been well documented, is in being with these people. I didn't feel these people were real. I didn't feel how they reacted to the situations were all that real.
Okay, well, Paul DiMaselli in Amawalk, New York, I hope I'm saying that right, on this very note, Maddie, he says, I have to disagree with Maddie about Cloverfield. Yes, the film is an 85-minute amusement park ride, but the way it captures the pandemonium is appropriate. It is entertaining and filled with edge-of-your-seat action. Something new is created in the new perspective the film presents with no words about why the monster comes to New York or what the other people in the country are thinking about the destruction. It is just about the Rob, Beth, Hud, Jason, Lily, and Marlena experience. The characters do lack a little depth, but would a normal person in this situation express their full personality of quirky traits? I know you're not looking for Rainn Wilson Juno quirk here, but I think overall the characters were convincing enough as I was rooting for the main characters to get out in the end. I would agree with that.
Well, I think it's absolutely fine. I think he made my review. I think we're saying the same things. He's just saying he embraces the sort of universal theme park ride more than I do. I was just looking for a little bit more.
Fair enough, and we do have a lot of great feedback here that unfortunately we're not going to be able to fit into this segment. Frank Kapp in Long Island, New York was also someone who wrote in and mentioned that he thought the stakes of Cloverfield, which we talked a little bit about, were extremely high. He even said that they rivaled the first 45 minutes of Saving Private Ryan.
Okay, well, yes, you're right.
Storming the beaches of Normandy.
Well, if you're going to buy the assumption that a monster is indeed attacking New York, well, then yes. Those stakes are on par with, say, an invasion. Of course, I would never make that comparison.
No, and I wouldn't either, because I actually made the comment during our show that the problem with the film is, even though this is what it's doing by design, I understand that, is it is only focused on the experience of those 6 characters, as our previous listener mentioned. So you can't really say the stakes are that high when the fact is the movie really does only focus on what they're doing. The stakes of this film are not what's going to happen to New York, what's going to happen to all the people around the country. It's, is Rob going to get to Beth in time? That's the stakes of this film.
Well, see, I think this is why we had different reactions to this film. I didn't care if this guy went to go get Amber or whatever her name
Beth.
Is. Beth. Okay? Yeah. I didn't care. I didn't believe that for a second. I thought they were really bland people. I was actually more into this monster eating everything up.
Yeah, and we don't see a ton of the monster in the film. Well, as always, thanks to everyone for the great feedback. If you have a comment for us, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, a conversation with the director of one of the most buzzed about Sundance films. Stay with us.
Dad never made her try too hard enough.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like FilmSpotting. Log on to audible.com/filmspotting to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting for your free audiobook.
You're a very nosy fellow, kitty cat, huh? You know what happens to nosy fellows? Huh? No? Want to guess? Huh? No? Okay. They lose their noses. Next time you lose the whole thing, cut it off and feed it to my goldfish.
Welcome back. That was a clip from Roman Polanski's 1974 classic Chinatown. Jack Nicholson and Polanski himself in that scene. Adam, you were dying to see the new documentary on the notorious legal case involving Polanski, who, of course, has been living in exile in France for the past 30 years after being convicted of unlawful intercourse with a minor here in the States.
I was, and I was dying to talk with the film's director, Marina Zanovich, after seeing the movie at Sundance. I caught up with her on my last day at the festival, and I started by asking why she wanted to tell this story, which digs into the details of exactly what happened back in 1977 between Polanski and his 13-year-old accuser, the ensuing court battle that resulted in him spending 42 days in prison and ultimately leaving the country.
In January of 2003, there was an article in the LA Times that talked about if Roman Polanski were to be nominated for Best Director for The Pianist, whether he would be able to come back or not. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. And then he got nominated, and as the story unfolded, the girl from the case, Samantha Geimer, and her lawyer appeared on the Larry King show, and her lawyer said something that really made me spend the next 5 years of my life kind of investigating this. He said the day Roman Polanski fled was a sad day for the American justice system. And that just didn't make sense to me. So I just started looking for the people. I, you know, found his number and met with him. And it turned out that someone I knew the prosecutor. They're Mormon, actually.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, he said, well, I know him. He's the bishop at my church. And it was just like one of those moments, you know,
yeah.
I have to do this. And then it was harder to find Polanski's lawyer. I finally got his number, and then he refused to talk to me. And then he finally agreed. And then it was like, you know, a 2-year courtship.
Really?
Yeah.
How much did you know about the case before you started the project?
Well, I mean, I'm the same age as the girl, so I remember the case. I didn't know that much. I mean, I remember just that it was, you know, lurid. But no details, and that he fled the country.
Every documentarian, no matter how objective they try to be, they're going to come into any project with some kind of bias, with some kind of perspective. What perspective did you have coming in, and what did you expect to maybe get out of it and learn about this case?
Well, I'm most interested in people's behavior. I was fascinated by everyone's behavior in this. The mother of the girl, Roman Polanski, the judge in the case, the prosecutor. I didn't have any bias. I mean, what I really wanted to do is just put the facts out there and try to tell it in an interesting way, because believe me, there are a lot of facts.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, hard. Do we just have people talking? Do we have text? I mean, it's a hard story to grasp, seriously, because there's so many details.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited that people here are responding, because we didn't know. I mean, you have no idea when you bring a film here what's going to happen.
Well, you talked about the text and the interviews and how you go about that. How did you come about the visual strategy of the film and the decision specifically to use some of the scenes from Polanski's films in the movie?
Well, it's funny. My producer always wanted to have scenes from his movies, and I thought it was a good idea, but I didn't know how it would work. And then I thought, am I missing something? It's a good idea, but aren't other people talking about other things happening going to be, isn't that going to take you out of the movie? So my instincts were right, because we ended up using scenes of images or facial expressions,
yeah,
especially of Roman Polanski,
right,
which I really like. And then his short film at the end, The Fat and the Lean, that was an utterly inspired choice that came up because we couldn't get some rights to some photographs of the judge. And it was really, it was this scene that, that part of the movie was like, what are we going to do? I mean, the judge is dead, you know, we don't have Polanski. It's just what, how are we going to make this interesting? And I think somehow we pulled it off. I mean, we had a lot of archive. The text we did very late in the story, just because there's a lot of talking and, you know, you don't want, I mean, talking heads can be interesting if you're following the story, but it's not radio.
Right.
You know, do you know in documentary they say a radio cut? Like, do you know that?
No.
Yeah. When you first are cutting something together, you're trying to create the story in the editing room. So it's called a radio cut. Hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The Fat and the Lean, you, this is the piece, right, where Polanski is kind of the jester dancing for the old man, right? That's an interesting scene, and you're right, it's a perfect example, perfect visualization of what we're seeing in the story. Did you fear, though, that that might be an example where it felt like your hand as a director really commenting too much and making a very obvious statement about where you feel about this, as opposed to being that kind of objective, just saying the facts?
No, because I think you don't need that to see how the judge was playing with Roman Polanski.
Right.
So it's just, to me, an entertaining and interesting way to say, you know, if I were to tell you this, this is what it would look like.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm Michael Moran. I have this agenda, free Roman Polanski, or, you know, he should be put behind bars. I mean, I really, I don't, that's not what I'm about. And I think films are really what the person who's making them is about. And I just, I'm interested in people. I'm interested in the story. I'm interested how most people think they know this story and they don't.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
It's certainly true that when you get to the end of it, despite maybe going into it not trying to have a definite point of view, when you come out, it's impossible to not see something obviously went wrong in terms of the justice system here, right?
Right.
You talked about Polanski, and you mentioned that you didn't get him, and I'm of course not surprised that he wouldn't want to talk about this. I mean, the whole media aspect of this is a huge part of this story, maybe the biggest part of the story. But what effort did you make to try to get him, if at all?
Excuse me. I tried to contact him at the beginning. I sent him a fax. I don't even know if he ever got it. I ended up kind of getting interviews with his friends because I met his godson, and, you know, it's all about access.
Yeah.
So his people knew about me, but I didn't attempt to interview him until the end this past summer, basically. And I didn't really think that I needed him, but I wanted the interview because don't we all want a good interview?
Of course. Yeah.
So I contacted him, and it took him a while to respond, and then he just apologized and said, you know, I want to help you, but I think it would look like self-promotion. Mm. And I think it would. I mean, I think his instincts were right. I don't think we need Roman Polanski to tell this story. I think this is a story told about what happened to him. And it's more interesting when it's told by other people.
Yeah. We're talking with Marina Zanovic here about her film Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, that is playing here at the Sundance Film Festival. You talked about access, and beyond not getting Roman Polanski, was there anyone else you wanted to get on camera that you thought was crucial to the story that you didn't get?
Well, there were a lot of people. I mean, I wanted more people who were closer to the judge.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a lot of people about the judge. I wish I could have interviewed him, but he died in, I think, 1993 or 1994.
He certainly would have turned down the interview. He would have wanted to be on camera, right?
I mean, it appears that way.
Yeah.
You know, I really, this story has affected me. I mean, when I drive around Santa Monica and drive by the courthouse, which looks exactly the same, or old restaurants in LA that are now being torn down. I mean, these were the haunts of these people.
Yeah.
And it's made LA like more eerie and interesting for me. The other person I would like to interview was the mother, of course,
right.
But she didn't want to be interviewed. So we tried.
Mm-hmm. How tempting was it to use this as an opportunity as well to explore Polanski's films? Or maybe not at all, because you just wanted to keep it focused on the case. But certainly people within the film, we see the district attorney. He went and saw the films at a film festival and drew all sorts of conclusions about the themes in his work.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the DA, I think he didn't know Roman Polanski from Adam.
Yeah.
So I guess he wants to go and see the films. I mean, it's that must have been pretty funny when, you know, he sat down for Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah,
or
Repulsion.
Oh, my God. Well, I watched all the films. Of course, I'd seen a lot of them before, but it was, I looked at the films looking for ways to incorporate scenes from the films into the movies, into my movie. We talked about it for a long time, but you really can't do it until you have a solid cut of the film, and then you can kind of put it in.
Were you a big Roman Polanski fan coming
yeah,
in?
Yeah, I've always been a fan of Roman Polanski's work. I think he's a fascinating artist. I think he is a craftsman. You know, he's Chinatown is a perfect film,
yeah,
I think.
I agree. Do you think there is any validity to the argument that I think some people would put forth? It's interesting. I think Woody Allen's film Bullets Over Broadway, John Cusack's character makes an argument there that the artist creates his own moral universe. And it kind of says that the artist gets to get away with more than maybe the rest of us average Joes do. Do you think there's any truth to that? I mean, does Polanski's brilliance not let him off the hook for what he did, but allow us to give him more room to wiggle, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think once you have a window into the world of Hollywood, you know, the higher stratospheres that a lot of us don't get a look at, it does seem that anything is possible. And I mean, it's like the music business.
Yeah.
People throwing themselves at musicians, rock stars, or actors. Actors or rock stars taking advantage of groupies. I mean, it's it's another world. So, and it's not a world that I know. I did once have the great pleasure of seeing Jack Nicholson at a party at the New York Film Festival and seeing women throwing themselves at him. I mean, it was, there were like four of us just watching as if it was an event. It's fascinating, you know?
Yeah.
But that's our culture, and you want to be around these people because they've been created as some sort of mythic figure.
How did your view of Polanski as a person and as a filmmaker change as the process went on, if it did?
Well, in doing the research, I was really surprised to find that at a certain moment in Roman Polanski's life, he had a lot of hope. And what I tried to do with the Sharon Tate archive was to create a life for them, because it's always just about her murder.
Yeah.
And I just, I'm getting the chills. I like love this idea that they had a life, you know, that he was the hottest director in Hollywood. He had the most beautiful woman in Hollywood, and he was at the top of everything. And then, you know, as Mia Farrow says, it all collapsed. And she also says he didn't have the blueprint for life that all of us have, which is very interesting. He didn't. Does that excuse him from what he did? My God, no. My feelings about him have gone back and forth, but I don't really think that matters. I mean, it's not about my feelings. It's about what you think as the audience.
Well, I just wanted to close by asking you about the process of getting this made. I'm sure a lot of my listeners are curious about how you go about making a documentary. And you talked about getting that spark when that story happened, and then the next thing you knew, you were spending 5 years on this. Really, what is that process like?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's just a series of one good day, one bad day. You know, you get the idea, then you have to somehow write it down, but you don't really know exactly what it is, so you kind of fudge it, you know. Mm-hmm. Then you have to go look for the money, and, you know, you have to make a living while you're doing all this. So it's very hard. But it's somehow, for me, I studied journalism and I was an actress, and it's like a combination of, I love interviewing people. I love telling stories. I love getting stories out of people. So I'm not a journalist, but I kind of have that. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing job. Not that you asked me, but just because you get to delve into these worlds and just find out everything, and then you go to something else.
Yeah.
It's kind of like your job, you know? It's a very long process, and when people do finally see it, I mean, you're just like, you can't even process it. It's because it's such a struggle.
Yeah.
You know?
Over how long did you conduct the interviews?
I started filming in January of 2003, and that was, we filmed for like 2.5 months. We traveled all over. I mean, we filmed a lot of people that weren't in the film.
Hmm.
You know, it's just getting all the information and then seeing what you really need. And then you don't want to have too many characters because people get confused. And with Polanski, there are people from different parts of his life. But the main focus was the court case and trying to get the best people. So when I got the lawyers to agree, you know, I mean, that was huge.
Yeah.
There was a time when I had a cut of the film very early on that didn't have Polanski's lawyer in it. It just had cards.
Dalton. Yeah.
Yeah, it just
I can't imagine it without him. He's great.
Oh, no. It's so much information. We just had cards that said, quote from Dalton, quote from Dalton. It was like every other shot.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I brought him in to show him that because I think he's sorry that what happened with this case, he didn't know how this was going to turn out.
Yeah. Well, you said, too, you get to then move on to something else. Do you have something else in the works right now?
I have this thing with French men. I find them very interesting. I guess I like to go to France.
That too.
So I did a film about a French businessman named Bernard Tapie and now Polanski. And I think to finish my trilogy, I think I want to do something about Sarkozy, the French president. Yeah.
Well, it sounds interesting. Best of luck with that. And congratulations on the success here. I know the film has sold. That's great. I really enjoyed it as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Again, that was director Marina Zanovich discussing her new film, Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. It was actually the first documentary to be sold at the Sundance Film Festival. HBO Documentary bought the U.S. rights. Weinstein Company purchased its international rights right after its world premiere last weekend. So you may see it in theaters, but definitely look for it on HBO at some point.
Time for one last quick break. When we come back, the top five movies we saw at Sundance this year and reflections on the life and work of actor Heath Ledger. So stay with us. She rides into the night up the mountainside and puts herself into a trance. She listens to the sound of her heart beating and dreams about the sea so endlessly. She's not the way she wants to be. She's not the way she used to be. She thinks about the sun and stars, hoping that she can rise above. She can. Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
I think the first film we'll mention here, Maddie, Groundhog Day, the 15th anniversary edition. Apparently it's very similar to the special edition that came out several years ago, but there are newly discovered deleted scenes. As we know, many of our listeners, big fans of the movie Groundhog Day. Also, Monty Python's Life of Brian, the Immaculate Edition. This is a movie that already had a Criterion release earlier, but we do have a commentary here, deleted scenes, a script read through, a photo gallery, another movie I know there is surely a cult following for.
This is my favorite Monty Python movie, actually. I'm not a Holy Grail guy. Yeah. I love Life of Brian.
I think I'm right there with you. Also, Rocket Science, a movie that came out this year. That's out now on DVD. Martin Scorsese presents Val Lewton, the horror collection. I'm not familiar with his work at all, but of course Scorsese is involved, and there's a documentary that will be available separately that Martin Scorsese is involved with. And El Cid, the extras here on the second disc are featurettes with the producer Sam Bronston, the director Anthony Mann, and the composer Miklos Roza. And there are also vintage radio interviews with Charlton Heston and Sophia Loren and a making of documentary. So Anthony Mann, one of the great Western directors, of course, El Cid out now in a two-disc set. As always, you can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting Movie Store link at filmspotting.net.
We want to take time now to thank those listeners who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and generously donated some of their hard-earned money. We are humbled, of course, and thankful for any money thrown our way, and it goes a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. In gratitude, here are your patented Film Spotting nicknames. Alexander, the Burn Redeemer, a.k.a. False Prophet. That's a gold-level donation. Thank you, Alexander. Laura, Empire Waste. Robert, Reserved for Elvis, a.k.a. Present but Unaccounted for. Joshua, Pork Sandwich Ashtray. Keith, Hook Up the Doll. Robert, Knee Shooters. Leonard, Killer Mutant, and that's a Silver Club member. Chris, My Middle Name is Tense. Jennifer, Living Aerobicizing. Wilson, Eggs Rolls. Jessica, Chips, Dips, Chains, Whips, that's a Gold Club member. Keith, Wolfbait, and Richard, A Vet for Chloe.
As you can tell, I hope some of our listeners realize there that apparently Mr. Van Halgren recently watched Weird Science, because a lot of those nicknames are in fact references to the movie Weird Science. And again, we do appreciate all of the nicknames there. And Maddie, we might as well go ahead and mention it now. If you want your patented Sam Van Halgren nickname, time is limited. Sam's coming on the 200th episode of our show here in 5 weeks, roughly, and that will be the last time we do nicknames.
That's
so if you want one, you got to get it done. He'll be announcing them on show number 200. So look forward to that.
Hi, this is Todd Haynes, the director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You gonna do this again next summer?
Well, maybe not. Like I said, me and Alan's getting married in November. So, we're trying to get something on the ranch, I guess.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was a scene there from Brokeback Mountain. Heath Ledger as Ennis Del Mar in that scene. And, of course, we got the sobering news this week that Heath Ledger had passed away. Actually, we were both coming back from Sundance. I think I know I was flying back and got the news. A listener sent an email, and I was pretty much in shock. I couldn't believe it. Of course, your first thought is it must be a hoax. What was your reaction, Maddie?
I was absolutely shocked and sort of, you know, stoned off my feet. What a tremendous talent. And it, you know, it's funny because the last big thing we saw him do was I'm Not There, where he's sort of playing this James Dean character. So much talent, not just another pretty face. Of course, that's what makes him stand out. His performances, you know, not only in Brokeback Mountain, but also 10 Things I Hate About You and A Knight's Tale, the fluffier stuff that he got away from, and other movies like The Four Feathers. I mean, it's just terribly sad.
Yeah, it is, and it's a little bit eerie maybe. I know one listener at least pointed this out, that in our most recent podcast, our last show, I talked about Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight and was saying that I wasn't quite sure that he was going to completely pull off the Joker role. And of course, now I feel really terrible about saying that. But if you look at his body of work, even though I wasn't someone who really embraced him as an actor, I respected the choices that he made. And that's the thing. I mean, not only am I looking forward to The Dark Knight, but you look at movies like I'm Not There, and even a failure like The Brothers Grimm. He's trying to do interesting things, working with Terry Gilliam there, having fun in a movie like Lords of Dogtown. And, you know, the movie of his that really actually stands out for me in a way, the performance, and again, if you look at it, it's kind of creepy for me to maybe make this comparison, but the big scene in Monsters Ball between him and Billy Bob Thornton, I think, is absolutely incredible, and he's incredible in that movie, even though he's only in it for a little bit. So definitely sad news to hear this week about Heath Ledger, dead at 28. Let's get back into the Sundance swing of things, though, Maddie, here a little bit. We do just want to take a minute to thank everyone who came out to our Film Spotting meetup. Got together at the eating establishment last Saturday to have some lunch. We met up with John and Maria, Robert, Tony, CJ, Sean, and Chris. I hope I'm not leaving anyone out. Unfortunately, Mark Larson stopped by but couldn't join us for lunch, and I really have to thank John. What a great guy. He actually offered to take me to the airport Tuesday morning, and because he took me to the airport, that's how I got the interview with Marina Zanovich and was able to see a movie Tuesday morning. Otherwise, I would have had to head back before I could have accomplished any of those things. So how cool are our listeners?
We really do have the best listeners in the world. And it's funny because you go to these things and you don't know who's going to show up. And of course, they're some of the most intelligent, wonderful people you'd ever meet.
Yeah, we've never had a bad experience meeting up with listeners yet. They're always incredibly cool. So thanks again to everyone who came out. I do want to mention just a quick note on some of the interviews, because when we were previewing Sundance in the past couple shows, I did mention that I had planned interviews with Terry Kinney, a Chicago guy, to talk about the movie Diminished Capacity, Alex Gibney to talk about the movie Gonzo, and Carlos Brooks, a first-time filmmaker, his movie Quid Pro Quo. Unfortunately, those interviews all got canceled either by me due to a lack of time or by the studio people. They just couldn't fit the interviews in. So we will hopefully catch up with a few of these people at a later date. I know for sure we're going to plan on talking with Alex Gibney about Gonzo. So look forward to that in the coming months as that movie gets close to its release. Before we get into the movies that we really loved from the festival that stood out for us, do you have any just general Sundance thoughts on the experience, Maddie, of going to your first Sundance Film Festival?
Are you asking me if I saw Paris Hilton? Because that's the question I've been getting since I've landed back in Chicago. And I have to say, for the record, no.
No.
I didn't see Paris Hilton. My lawyer won't let me answer any other way. We did see Maria Bello.
Yeah.
We had a slice with Maria. We saw Bill Pullman, of course.
Alan Rickman, Quentin Tarantino.
It was actually a lot of fun. It was my first time, and I really, really, really enjoyed it. The hospitality is terrific, and they run a really, really tight ship. And I really liked the quality of the films.
Yeah, I do too, though I think I would say on the whole, and we'll get into this obviously as we get into our list, that compared to last year, down a little bit in quality, but of course we don't stay for the entire festival, so who knows what we're missing. But I didn't see any movies there as I get into my top five that would have made my top five, my top two anyway from last year. Black Snake Moan, Son of Rambo, Grace Is Gone might even be in there. So for me, the quality may be down a little bit. I do want to mention here, if you can't get enough Sundance talk from Film Spotting, you can actually hear some different shows with me. I got to sit in with Matt Singer and Allison from the IFC podcast, with Paul, Kevin, and Karina from the Spout podcast, Film Couch, and also I appeared on Chicago Public Radio's 848 the other morning to talk about Sundance. So if you want to listen to those, you can go to our press page at filmspotting.net and check those out. But it is time to get into our top five. I'm looking forward to this, Maddie, because we did have different experiences, kind of like we did in Toronto. This time you were at press and industry screenings too, just like I was. However, you had different tastes, you had different interests in the films you wanted to go to. We saw a good variety of films. What's your number five?
Okay, well, I don't have five. I only have four.
Really?
So, and I'm not ranking them.
Okay.
I know.
You're being difficult.
I know, I'm being difficult. But I had four that really, really stood out, and I didn't want to get into, you know, which one is better than the other.
Sure. So, I mean, because it's not like that's what we do here on Film Spotting.
Exactly. All right, well, I'm going to start with An American Soldier, The Recruiter, a film that you and I both saw. This is just a tremendous look at the makeup of our modern-day armed forces. It follows an army recruiter and three of his recruits through basic training. I personally am in awe of people like Sergeant Clay Yusei. Sales is very, very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
You have to believe in what you're selling. And I honestly believe Recruiter Sergeant Yusei believes wholeheartedly in the armed forces, and specifically the Army and his recruits.
I
think he really does care about their well-being, because when you think about it, our modern-day Army is comprised primarily of people from the lower economic classes.
Sure.
This is their shot in many ways at bettering their lives. It was really, really fascinating to watch, and I think really, really well handled.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right about Clay Yusei. I mean, you talk about maybe the leads being bad, like in Glengarry Glen Ross complaining about that. Imagine having to recruit people to the armed forces with a war going on in Iraq.
Yeah, not only in Iraq, but
in Afghanistan. Yeah, it does make things a little bit difficult. A good choice there by you. My number five is my one cheat. I have a tie. And the only reason I have a tie here is because one of the films I can't completely say would have made my top five, because I had to leave early, unfortunately, to get to an interview. So I missed the last 20 minutes of the film. But right now I've got Trans-Siberian and Choke. Trans-Siberian is the film from director Brad Anderson. We both saw this movie. It's kind of a modern take on Strangers on a Train with Woody Harrelson and Emily Mortimer traveling on the Trans-Siberian Express from Beijing to Moscow. And basically everything that could go wrong along the way goes wrong. And I think it's an effective little thriller. Unfortunately, I haven't seen any release date information yet about that film. I don't think it's been picked up yet, but I did like it. And then Choke. This is the Chuck Palahniuk adaptation, of course, the writer of Fight Club, with Sam Rockwell as a sex addict, a med school dropout. Kelly MacDonald is in it. And it's an interesting film, dealing with Angelica Houston as his mom, and he's trying to figure out who his dad really was. And it gets pretty crazy, but it's a very funny, dark comedy. Again, I had to leave 20 minutes early, so who knows, maybe it all falls apart, but I actually did like the film quite a bit. And this is a movie that did sell at the festival. Fox Searchlight bought it for $5 million. The crowd I was with was into it the whole time. So Choke is one to look forward to later this year.
All right, well, my quote-unquote number three is Slingshot Hip Hop. This is just, it's an infectious documentary. I really, really, really enjoyed it. It follows Tamer. He's what they call a 48 Palestinian, which is slang for a Palestinian living within the borders of modern-day Israel. He's young. He becomes inspired by the music of American rappers Public Enemy, N.W.A., and especially Tupac Shakur. He becomes the first Palestinian rapper rapping in Arabic and rails against Israel. His songs inspire other groups scattered throughout Palestine, some living in the West Bank, and one group living in the Gaza Strip who live in absolutely miserable conditions and are not even allowed to leave Gaza. It's a powerful verbal intifada using words instead of stones, a conflict, of course, I much prefer to the alternative.
Mm-hmm. Well, a good choice. It was one I didn't see, unfortunately, at Sundance, but would like to check out at some point. My number four is your number four as well, I guess, An American Soldier, a.k.a. The Recruiter. And I, just like you, was really caught up in this story. Clay Yusei, as its recruiter down in Louisiana, he's someone who at times you find yourself really not liking at all, because you do feel like he's giving the hard sell to these people. But at the same time, we need him. And
I only felt he was giving the hard sell that one time when he called that kid out on his stepdad.
Yeah.
That was the only time where I thought he was perhaps being a little less than altruistic.
Yeah, it's funny because his favorite line is, no disrespect here, but your stepdad's an idiot, is basically what he says, something like that. But what is really fascinating about the film is, you're right, it goes goes then from being about the recruiter to then the recruits. And it follows these three people as they go off to basic training. And they're all three way different people. Mm-hmm. They have different experiences, different backgrounds, and that's what makes it really good. So I agree. I like the film a lot. Directed by Edit Belzberg. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, Belzberg actually directed 2001's Children Underground, which is a film I'd seen. I didn't know she had done it.
Hmm.
It's about orphan teens living in a Romanian subway. It's very, very good. It was nominated for an Oscar that year.
Sounds really uplifting.
Exactly. All right, well, my number two is The Order of Myths. Mobile, Alabama is home to the longest-running Mardi Gras celebration in the U.S. It bills itself as a much more family-friendly affair than the more celebrated New Orleans party, and includes week-long celebrations comprised of masked balls and multiple parades put on by so-called mystic societies and crews, some of which trace their origins back to 1704. Sounds great, right?
Yeah.
Well, there is a catch. Blacks have been unable to participate in the parades outside of acting as torchbearers until they formed their own association about 50 years ago, originally called the Colored Carnival Association, later renamed to the Mobile Area Mardi Gras Association. So now there are two associations, each crowns their own king and queen. This movie is really sort of fascinating and terrifying all at the same time, because you think of like how far we think we've come with race relations and how far we really have.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. My number three, I've got another documentary here. I've actually got three docs in a row. I know you were a big fan of most of the docs here at the festival you saw, and it is Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. We, of course, talked with the director in the previous segment, but Marina Zanovich gets access to the victim, all the lawyers in the case, people close to Polanski, and it reveals so much about the case that I never knew. All I ever knew was that he got in trouble for apparently raping or something wrong with a girl who was obviously underage, and then instead of face the music, he fled the country. And it really is so much more complicated than that. And it doesn't whitewash Polanski. You can't. The facts speak for themselves. He had sex with a 13-year-old girl. He doesn't shy away from that. The movie doesn't shy away from that. But the details of the case and the reasons why he fled, I thought, were really illuminating. And you do come to a point where you understand that the justice system in this case truly failed, mainly because of a judge who had a taste for the limelight and who let his own personal emotions dictate the law. And some of the stuff we hear from the lawyers that went on behind closed doors is just mind-blowing. I'll go ahead and give my number two here as well. Again, another documentary, Stranded. This is the subject matter that became the movie Alive, the fiction narrative version of it. But the director, Gonzalo Arijon, I hope I'm saying that close to correctly, makes this film about the rugby team from Uruguay in October 1972 who crash-landed in the Andes Mountains and ended up staying there for 72 days on this frozen glacier. 16 of the 45 passengers survived it and managed to walk away from it. And you see the survivors 30 years later as they go back to the crash site with their children. Very moving, as you may imagine. You hear their accounts of what happened throughout the film, and they articulate it so well. Their perspective is amazing. And I also really liked how the struggle to survive is framed in the movie by the director and by the participants, like it was a crucible being administered by this cruel, omnipotent force. These were people, in this case, who were all in great shape. They were athletes. Mm-hmm. They were smart. They were university students. A lot of them were well-educated and mostly led pampered lives. So they were really, in a way, the perfect specimens to be involved in this kind of a test. Can you survive these circumstances? Somehow they did. It's amazing stuff.
Oh, it's one I was really looking forward to, and unfortunately I had to miss it. All right, well, my number one is Anvil. The Real Live Spinal Tap. This is a documentary. Anvil is a Canadian heavy metal band that was there when heavy metal launched in the early 80s. They played a huge concert with the Scorpions and Bon Jovi in Japan, but for some reason, which unfortunately goes unexplored in this documentary, they never took off. But they're still around today. They're still playing gigs while working day jobs in Toronto. And the documentary is made by one of their original fans, Sasha Gervaisi, screenwriter known for Spielberg's The Terminal. And it follows Anvil as it tours Europe playing in clubs in front of 10 people. And, of course, their latest album is rejected by every major label company, and yet they stay with it. It really is Spinal Tap. There's something so admirable and likable about the two original members that are still in the band, and they're at their best friends, Steve Lips Kudlow and Rob Reiner. Yes, his name Rob Reiner with two B's. You know, we laugh at them sometimes, but more often than not, you're just cheering. You're just hoping that they make it because they've been at this for 30 years.
Yeah.
Some of the scenes seem just a little staged, but overall, this film is just one hell of a good time.
Well, and you could see the members of Anvil and people from the film walking on Main Street, and everyone was stopping to look. Hey, it's those guys because they just come from the film. So I can't remember if this film has sold yet or not, but I know it was a big hit around the festival.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really wish I had seen it actually too, because I had planned on seeing something else in that time slot, and then I got closed out of it. So I missed Anvil and missed everything in that slot, unfortunately. My number one is American Son, another film with American in the title, and another film that deals with the Iraq War. And this is a movie with Nick Cannon, who I think really gives one of my favorite performances from the festival. He plays a Marine who has 96 hours to go back home to Bakersfield and meet with his family and friends before he gets shipped off to Iraq. And there's a lot of boys in the hood in this film in terms of the characters. Mike, the Nick Cannon character, is a lot like Cuba Gooding Jr. in that he's back in the old neighborhood and is a more straight-laced guy trying to do the right thing, and he's got some friends with a propensity to get into trouble. But the movie doesn't try to make any blatant political statements. I think it's worth noting that Mike joins the military. He becomes a Marine for the same reasons we see most of the people in American Soldier join. So you know that Neil Abramson, the director, and the guy who came up with the story, along with Eric Schmid, a first-time screenwriter, you know they're getting at some truths here. And there really wasn't a moment in this film that felt inauthentic. And the only real flaw I can say about American Son, which I really hope gets a release and everyone gets a chance to see, is that it does give us a countdown, the 96 hours ticking down to the time he leaves, and it really ends up making the movie feel longer than it should be.
That's a gimmick I wish would go away.
It's a gimmick, and it doesn't work here because it really makes you aware of how much time is left, and it doesn't always make sense how much time has passed, and it just isn't effective. It would have been better even if they just gone with the kind of day four, day three, day two kind of thing instead of the 96 hours. It would have been a lot more effective, but a really fascinating film. Again, that I thought too, very emotional in the scenes, the love story here. He gets involved with a girl that he meets on the bus going back to Bakersfield and, of course, doesn't want to tell her that he's about to go off to Iraq, and those scenes are really great.
Well, I only saw one of your top five.
Yeah, and I only saw one or two of yours,
and
I think.
And all mine were documentaries.
That's true. You are a big documentary guy.
Well, and I hope they do get picked up because they really, really are great.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, that is our top five for this week. You can find a complete list of the movies we saw at Sundance, including our star ratings at filmspotting.net. Please send any comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, How She Move, Meet the Spartans, Untraceable with Diane Lane. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Wow.
And yes, Rambo, expanding to more screens for their Oscar runs, Michael Clayton and No Country for Old Men.
On next week's show, we'll review Persepolis, an Oscar nominee for Best Animated Film, and share our top five coming-of-age stories. Now, the latest Woody Allen film, Cassandra's Dream, is in theaters, and of course, we have to spend a few minutes on Rambo at some point. But we also have to get back to our Ingmar Bergman marathon and the film Winter Light, so check out our calendar page at filmspotting.net for updates.
Thanks to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Utah Carol for this week's music. Learn more at utahcarol.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
Wilson egg roll. Eggs rolls?
I think so.
F*** you, Sam.
I wish I could use that as the outtake.
You should bleep it out.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You sound terrible.
I know. I can't help it. We should put in a disclaimer at the beginning.
I know.
I went to Film Spotting, and all I got was this lousy cold.